And we're live. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Eureka Podcast. This is your host, Matthew Trii, or Matt. You can call me Matt. Well, you can't call me anything. You're not on the other side. It's just me. But today I've got, Heineken. Today I've got a guest that goes by the name of Lewis Baglietto. But before we get into his story, I've got a co-host today, Louis Jim, a good friend of mine. Louis, introduce yourself. Say hello.
So hello. My name is Louis Jim. People know me as Louis. I attended Soto Grande School here with Matt, born and raised in France. And yeah, we're just here to have a good time and talk about life. So take it away, Matt.
Safe. So as I said, I've got Lewis Baglietto. There's one main reason why we came here to talk. And Lewis, what might that be? Can you enlighten everyone, please?
So summer 2019, mainly July, I spent a month in Tanzania doing a few things. So climbing a pretty tall mountain and teaching at school mainly. And then August, 5 days later, I basically got chopped up by the propeller of a boat. Which was a pretty cool experience overall, now looking back on it.
Pretty cool experience, yeah. That's how you describe it, is it? That was rare, dude. You sound like one of those surfer dudes surfed a mad wave. Yeah. That was a pretty cool experience.
10 out of 10 overall.
10 out of 10, yeah. But before that, you had your exams, right? So it was a pretty hectic summer.
Yeah, so June I had my GCSEs, July.
How did you do?
I got 10 A stars and an A.
Fuck it, hell, mate. Look at this. The guy. Wrong guy is getting stars. Chopped up by a boat, am I right?
So it was all going well. And then, July was pretty awesome, to be honest. I'd mixed emotions at first when going because I thought, oh, shit, I'm going to miss best summer so far. But then at the end of the day, the stuff I learned that trip was, I wouldn't change it for the world.
No, that's wicked. Like, it's cool at a young age because I think the first time I did proper traveling was 18, man. Yeah. And even so, it was because it was a gap year. So it was like this idea that not you're forced to go, but everyone does it, man. So I'm going to go traveling now. But you were, 16, you said, and you went to Tanzania?
Yeah, 16. It was probably
what made you go? Why?
I just wanted to immerse myself in a completely different culture. Something that I just never experienced. Because, we live here, obviously, in Soto, and I go to boarding school in England. And I've had an upbringing with kind of one perspective on the world. All the people around me have probably had this similar sort of upbringing, similar sort of perspective, and I just wanted to get a completely different look on it all. And obviously do my bit to help out there. So I got a teaching certificate, taught English and maths. And it was really cool, really rewarding, because now some of them who I'd taught actually did their A levels recently and are able to, move out of the village and go to university and stuff.
So, yeah. Mate, that's wicked. But so how was that organized? How did it come about? Who told you about it? Where did you hear about it?
Yeah, so my school, they've got a link with this village in Tanzania called Gahandu. And basically 10 years ago, Gahandu was like nothing. It was completely desolate. There was no electricity, no water, nothing. And so we started doing trips yearly. A really good teacher, basically set up the whole thing, asked whoever wanted to come in my year. We all signed up, those of us that did, and went out. And it was a great experience.
Nice.
Yeah, it's good. It's cool to do that at such a young age, I feel like, immerse yourself in that kind of culture. Must be pretty eye-opening, for sure.
I agree. The schools, I think Soto School did one. Yeah. My sister went
to
India.
They do, Uganda. Yeah. They do, Uganda trips. Azni also in Morocco. I attended that one.
You did that one? Yeah, was that about?
Yeah, it was really nice. Well, it was just, it's a very small village, and you kind of just... You visit the local schools and things like that, see the kids kind of help around. And as I say, it's a very eye-opening experience to do at such a young age. Because as you say, with the upbringing we've had and things like that, it's true. Good to put yourself in those positions.
And it's crazy because some of these people, they have to wake up at 4 a.m., walk hours on end, get to school at 10 a.m., go through a whole day's work, and then only get back home at around 11 and do the whole thing again. And they do it with a smile on their face the whole time.
Yeah.
And it just makes you think, oh, I'm here in my school
first lag. World problems.
Yeah, exactly.
That saying
exactly.
like rings true so much. Yeah, I remember yeah. that's happened to me before as well. I remember being in Nepal and they only eat two meals a day, really. They have, and it's always rice. And it's like, you know, you could look at yourself when you're sitting down at, having a nice sort of, I don't know, burger in Bocana or whatever it is. And, and it's not al punto like you asked, and you asked to send it back.
Yeah, you and get then you,
yeah, again. And sometimes you're in that moment and you're like, fuck, like, let me just check myself for a moment. Like, I was eating rice every day for 3 months in Nepal, like only two meals a day, and I was fine with that. You know, there's people around the world that can't eat, so.
And I think it's like one of the most frustrating things is that it's not their fault. They were born into something that is probably a result of the Western world kind of exploiting those areas, and we're benefiting massively from it. And so just to at least be able to acknowledge that it's there is the least we could do somewhere like here.
Yeah. But, you know, by the same token, like, you don't know anything different. I mean, would you guys agree with that? Like, if you grow up in a world, that's just your reality.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're saying. Like, having that kind of upbringing, you know, being used to one culture, one way of thinking, you know. So, yeah, it gives you another outlook on things.
So you have this amazing experience in Tanzania, which we'll definitely come back to. There's a lot to be said.
Yeah.
And you said five days later, you had the accident. Can you sort of tell us, you know, what happened? What happened that day?
Yeah, yeah. So I just got landing at Heathrow. I was so excited to do, you know, my first shit in an actual toilet for the first time in a while.
Did they have the ones that you squat in?
It was just a hole in the ground of the field.
Yeah, okay. Oh, wow.
Interesting. So I was buzzing to be back. And then, so I then flew back to Jib. And I was ready. I was so ready to celebrate this summer. I'd gone out and done something really rewarding. I'd learned a lot. And then I had a few parties, classic. Soto Grande summer, really.
What are the parties like in Soto Grande for a 16-year-old something man?
Yeah, true. But they are, you know, really good fun.
Yeah.
It's when you start creeping into the 18th scene. So you go to a few 18ths, which are always amazing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so then it was the 5th of August. Me and six mates, really, really good mates of mine, went out on a boat just here, quite standard procedure, really. We all had a great time, wouldn't trade the day for the world. And then somehow I end up under the boat, just completely getting chopped up in the legs. Last thing you expect, really. You're living this paradise 10 minutes earlier, and before you know it, you're looking death right down
the barrel.
Right down the barrel.
Right in there. So, yeah, that's mad, first of all. What was going on? Like, what were the first thoughts that was going through your head?
Yeah, so basically I fell in, and what it did is it just sucked me in completely, the propeller. And I was lucky it hit my legs from the knee below only. And I was just getting tangled and tangled in this mess, really, fighting for what was
survival.
My life. And this, like, this is when your animalistic instincts kick in, really. I remember just not feeling like a human at that point. I was just reduced to this, like, sort of state of just survival. Sort of thing you'd see on, like, David Attenborough, you know?
Yeah.
Animal just running for its life.
Was there any, like, imagery in your head? Could you see things?
Yeah.
You know, did your life flash before your eyes?
Yeah, not like, quite like in a film, but I remember there was definitely this sense of, there's no way I'm dying this way, sort of thing.
Oh, really?
A real motivation kicks in to just do anything you can to survive. And then luckily I escaped the propeller. Some people will put it down to sheer luck, others to God, others to whatever they want to put it down to. I got out and I swam with my arms. And I remember thinking I had so much adrenaline that I genuinely convinced myself that I'd got out uninjured. Because that's just, your brain does all these awesome things when you're in that state. So obviously I swam with my arms, having started to sink down to the bed. I swam to the side of the boat and I was just like, to my mates, get me out of the water. And then I just remember seeing a sea of hands off the side of the boat, all just, you know, wanting to help.
How did you, like, do you remember how you got out of the propeller? Like, I mean, one question I had was like, how useful were your hands? I know it might sound silly. How useful were your hands in that situation?
Thankfully, my hands didn't go near the propeller.
No, as in your arms to escape.
Yeah, they must have been.
I mean,
the truth is that there are some things that you just can't explain.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, yeah. And this is one of them. You were there.
It just happened so fast.
Yeah, everything. Well, yeah, because I was one, suffocating, and two, you know, had this problem with my legs getting, you know, chopped up. And so,
slight issues.
Also, what I was thinking is obviously the time situation, right? So how long were you under? Obviously, there's a question of breathing. Yeah. You know, like when you're panicking in those situations, it must be, you know, hard to keep your breath there and stuff.
Yeah, so. Well, it's the classic, like, it felt like an eternity.
Yeah, really. Exactly.
But it did feel like an eternity. And somehow, it all stopped and I got out. I couldn't give you an answer. I have no idea how it happened.
Yeah.
Must have flashed so quick for him, I feel like.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
yeah. I mean, I don't know. Have you had any near-death experiences or anything? I mean, that's a pretty serious
not
one.
Not really. Not that I can think of, really. I had one the other day. Motorbike crashes, but they weren't too bad. You know?
What, on the moped?
Yeah, like mopeds, 50 cc's. But
I had one the other day, actually, which is weird, because I remember the day it happened, I told everyone I saw that day. And then it's weird that I haven't told it since then, because I completely forgot about it. But I went to Sally Sol literally a couple of months ago. I went to Sally Sol, which is the one, Buller's Beach, as we call it.
And best forever, beach in the area.
Lovely beach. I mean, if you don't like sand and cleaning sand off when you leave the beach, this is the beach for you. It's just only pebbles. It's nice. But yeah, I was there with this girl who I met when I was 18, traveling in Chile. So like 6 years before, hadn't seen her in time. And she was in town. She was around. She knows someone who lives in Soto Grande, so she was staying with them. And she hit me up, was like, oh, what are you doing? So we went for lunch. And you know how that beach there can get really wavy and the waves tend to suck people out. Mm-hmm. It was one of those days and the waves were like really big, but if you stayed, you know, within the shore, you would have been fine. And of course, the waves are so strong and like smacking you, it's very uncomfortable to be close to the shore. So we swam out a little bit. And I remember turning to her and saying, you know, you got to watch out because I've been here on a day having lunch where people have been sucked out and then the whole beach is just watching like what's going to happen and waiting for the people to come save them. So she was like, yeah. And, you know, we sort of carried on talking, like bobbing like that, facing each other, having a chat. And maybe 30 seconds go by and we're like really far out. And I'm like, kind of casually, like, okay, we should probably start swimming in now. Like this could get dangerous. Yeah. And we start swimming and I realize I'm not going anywhere. I'm like, fucking hell. And then like, I'm trying to keep calm, but panic just starts going in her mind, which is the worst thing. So I thought that she could swim with me, but that wasn't the case. So I had to hold her with one hand, swimming like that. And it probably took me around 4 minutes. Like any longer I would have been, I was shattered. Like any longer I would have, I don't know, drowned. Yeah. And we finally got to the shore and just like, I fell to my knees and was just like, breathing super heavily. Yeah, it was fucking scary.
Have you seen the film Chasing Mavericks?
Nah, I haven't.
There's a really good scene in it when basically the main character has to do some hard task, you know, most films. And in this case, it's surfing Mavericks. And his sort of mentor goes, fear and panic are two different things. Fear is healthy, panic's not. And it's true.
Oh,
like, when you're going through shit, you know, you got to keep your head.
Yeah, I like that.
For sure.
So going back to the accident, so your legs get chopped up. I mean, what happens immediately after that? I mean,
so once I'm on, because when I was in the water, I was for sure I'm dead, you know?
Yeah.
That's just the truth. Then once I was on the boat, I remember my friends, they were amazing. They tied these knots with towels and there was almost no blood loss. And I was like, oh shit, okay, so I'm going to live, hopefully.
Let me interrupt you there. Before you carry on, when we spoke before in preparation with this, you mentioned something about these chaotic thoughts that came to you immediately.
Could
you touch on that? Yeah, like.
So once I was on the boat, I was like, okay, I'm going to live, but I'm not going to have. Well, the main fear was that I'm not going to be able to walk, sort of thing. So
it's a madness.
It was almost as if my whole future, my whole life, and this was at a very early stage, and it was almost more painful than the actual pain itself, was the thought that I'd come to the realization that obviously I hadn't, that I wouldn't be able to walk again and that I'd be living in a future without you know, all these things that I'd kind of taken for granted or expected of my life, from things as simple as, you know, just taking a jog down to Bunker Beach. That was the most scary thing. It felt like I had a very vivid image when it was happening of just like a fragile vase just being shattered all over the floor, because that's really what it felt like. And that hurt way more than the pain itself, because I mean the pain was pretty bad as well. Once the adrenaline had gone down, it started kicking in. But mental pain's a lot worse than physical pain on every level.
Mm. And like the other thought I had was, how deep was that train of thought? Like, how far did it go? Was it like, will I ever have a relationship again? Or will I be in a wheelchair? Or will I be, you know, how far did that
go? Yeah, so when we were driving into the port, my friend called the ambulance. And the ambulance thought it was a prank call. Classic Spain. So they actually didn't come. So we ended up waiting for a lot longer than I expected. A lot of these thoughts did come in. So it wasn't as far as that, but it was definitely more near future things. Okay. Things as simple as
I think going back to the age thing, because obviously you were 16 right at the time. So I mean, having these thoughts at that age, you know, you're like young, you're playing football, shit, all these things, you know, like it must be such a traumatic thing to be thinking, like so many doubts for the future in that moment, you know.
Yeah, I remember another thing, because obviously you're thinking about yourself, your future, loads. But I remember one thing in particular was fear for those around me. So when you're in a situation like this, I think it's some sort of animalistic thing as well, that I was just, it's like your maternal, well, your cries for your mother. Like, yeah. I was crying for my mom, and I'm not embarrassed about it, you know. It's just the fact I was screaming like a little boy stuck, lost in Supergo or something, you know.
Yeah.
Just for my mother, and I don't know why.
It's so amazing. When you told us that when we were prepping for this, that really blew my mind. It's just like, as I said last time we spoke, that, you know, you remember seeing movies, Saving Private Ryan, of these guys on their last legs, they've been shot. And that's what they're crying for. They're crying for their mum. And I never really thought that it was like,
completely
based on truth. Like, yeah,
completely. I was screaming for my mum. And it's just one of those things that you can't really get your head around. So there was a lot of fear of that. A lot of fear of, so what are my family going to have to adjust to their lives as well as myself?
And then, so talk us through the, you made a really, really cool dichotomy in this whole thing on the humorous side of things, you know, the deep stuff that you've just spoken about, and then the humor that kicked in that had really helped you through it, not just the event, the day, but in the future as well.
Yeah, so I was really lucky, because my coping mechanism, and those on the boat will tell you, was humor. And it was a weird little paradox, because on the one hand, you know, you're living your hell, and on the other hand, you're cracking all sorts of weird jokes, almost coming out as a reflex. So some pretty funny moments. One including, so when the ambulance finally did come, I was right, we were berthed right outside El Ke, the restaurant in the port. And so it came and it parked alongside us, and we had to get me from the boat to the ambulance. And so when I was in the stretcher, and these men were lifting me into the ambulance, a crowd, I realized, had formed around, you know, as they always do. And there was a pretty good looking, attractive girl around my age.
There always is.
So I just managed, out of a film, you know. And I just managed to kind of gain the energy to just lean forward, wink at her, and say, Yamame.
Yamame for my English listeners. Oh my God. Says, is call me.
She never did. But then again, I never gave her my number.
God, can you imagine that situation if you're her?
Yeah.
Like, how do you respond to that?
Her face was brilliant.
Yeah.
But I think it was important, not just for me, but for those around me. It really calmed them down as well, I think.
For sure.
You know, I won't speak for them. But so my dad obviously came rushing down. My mum couldn't, because she was also in a wheelchair at the time with a broken ankle. Oh, wow. But my dad came rushing down, and he seemed really worried. But then I started making all these jokes, in jokes we have with each other. I called him, you know, Gibraltarians will understand. I said, ¿Qué pasa, compa? Things
¿Qué pasa,
like that.
Compa?
Yeah, ¿Qué pasa, hijo? And he, you know, it just relaxed him a bit. He was like, okay, he's all right. He's not suffering too much.
Yeah, because you're like, you know, people are so reactionary in the moment. And you're so right. Like, although your legs were all chopped up, like if you can put him at ease in that way.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's like freaking awesome.
And that's one thing I'm so grateful for was the people on the boat. It was almost as if angels had come over them because none of them panicked. They were all just amazing. And they all just helped so much and so effectively that I've got a lot to thank for them.
Yeah. No, I find that incredible as well because you hear that a lot in these sort of stories that people step up.
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is a bunch of like 17, 16-year-olds, you know, just living some summer on their boat having fun.
Yeah.
I feel like if you think hypothetically, like you wouldn't put yourself in those situations, but when they actually do happen, like your instincts and, you know, kind of kick in and you kind of know where to be helpful, you know?
As you said, like, you know, one story that just reminded me. Yes, man, I saw this on YouTube. This guy that like got lost at sea, you hear all these sort of stories. And I remember seeing like the story of a guy that was lost at sea for like, I don't know, 100 days, no, 74 days, something like that. And it's the same sort of thing, like the ingenuity of being on a raft and the things that he had with him and how he used them to fish. It's like, you know, your life is on the line. You've got to come up with something.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, like Cast Away, the film.
I haven't seen that. Is that the Tom Hanks one?
Yeah, similar sort of thing. That you just end up becoming so like innovative and stuff when you're on a desert island and you've
Bear Grylls that shit, man.
Yeah. You'd be surprised of the power of the mind, really. I know it's cliche to say that, but it's very true. You know?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Sick, man. So that happens. And I mean, what happens after that? What your next couple of days, you know,
talk us through the ambulance journey. I recall a funny story.
True.
So then I get into the ambulance, and before we go to the humorous side, there is something pretty amazing that happened in the ambulance, which was, so I was lying down and I thought that, you know, my future had just been completely smashed into pieces. And the first thing I asked the woman who was in the ambulance was, oh, will I be able to walk again?
Wow. Yeah.
Imagine
her.
Yeah, exactly. And she, you know, touched my legs, worked her magic and said, yeah, you will. And at that moment, it was as if all my pain did just completely vanish. I felt no pain.
Wow.
And it was almost as if that broken vase had just come back together again. It was amazing. Best feeling.
That's cool.
Either that or it's because they just put a shit ton of morphine in me.
And I got high. So high.
Probably the latter, man.
I think a mix of them both.
A mix of them both.
For sure.
But yeah, I got so high. All I remember is Thomas the Tank Engine just flying through the sky. And then when I woke up in the hospital, because they rushed me to the La Linea hospital, because by duty they have to take you to the nearest one. And they'd performed surgery on me straight away when I arrived. And I remember waking up a few hours later with loads of people bringing me Lego. And I was like, why is everyone bringing me Lego? I'm Lego. 16. And apparently it's because when I was really high, that's all I was asking for.
No
Lego.
Way, yeah. Man.
Yeah.
That's freaking awesome.
So the child in you never leaves.
No way.
Did you have like recollection of what you were saying or what you were thinking whilst you were in that moment, or not really?
Is
that why you were surprised they brought you Legos?
Yeah,
I completely blacked out.
Okay, I remember one thing, which was just me joking around with my dad a bit, but after that I was completely gone.
Interesting. Shit. And then what? So when you came to, was it the next day? You'd had after the operation?
So the accident itself happened around 7 p.m. Okay. 7:30. So by the time all this had happened and I come out of the operation theatre, it was around 2 a.m. And
you're awake?
And I woke up during the operation.
No way.
Just feeling them pulling away at my legs. But I had a sheet. I couldn't see anything. And then they took me out and I got wheeled over to my room. Little was I to know that I wouldn't leave that bed for 2 weeks.
Wow.
But I then had a FaceTime call with my family who wasn't at the hospital at the time and a few of my friends who were on the boat. And it was great. It was great to just sort of reassure them, because as hard as it was for me, like, people forget, you know, it could have been pretty hard for them experiencing something like that.
That's true.
We grew a lot closer. And I love the people who were on that boat that day. You know, it's,
Do you think there'll be forever, that's got to be a thing, right? A forever bond between you and the people on that boat.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think anyone who like endures some sort of hardship to a certain extent with other people will always feel attached to them in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Nice.
What about, so you said you were 2 weeks in the hospital, right? So why don't you tell us a little bit about like what it was like? I mean, what was your journey? What were you doing, you know?
These 2 weeks were probably the worst and best 2 weeks of my life. It was an emotional roller coaster to the extreme. So I was literally reduced to a baby. And it's weird because it's like a cycle, you know? It's as if I'd been reborn after this. Because I was there in a hospital wearing a nappy, not being able to leave this bed, not being able to even use a wheelchair, literally just lying down for 13 days. And it was quite something. So a few examples are, so every morning, since I couldn't go and have a shower or go to the loo, these women would just come in, 7 a.m., rise and shine, and they just strip me down completely and just start scrubbing me tip to toe, which is quite a weird experience. Stuff like that.
That must have got easier after the first couple of times.
I was so embarrassed. I was so humiliated. But by the end of it, I was just like, yeah, got my dick. I just have a give it a scrub.
Yeah, at this point, it needs a clean. It's been a long time.
At this point, I don't even care. But another thing is, since obviously I had quite a lot of trauma in the first few weeks, mentally, I couldn't actually shit. So I didn't go to the loo for 8 days. I just couldn't. And so these two men, they come in one day wearing gloves. They say, all right, we're going to give you something to help you go to the loo. And I was there thinking, all right, they're going to give me a tablet or a drink or something. And all my family started to slowly leave the room, and I'm thinking, what's going on here?
They told them before.
I don't want to see this.
I remember looking over to my cousin and being like, please, please, can you stay? And he was like, absolutely not, mate. I mean, I love you, but no way. And so these two men walk in a few minutes later with...
Wait, first of all, like, why two men?
I know, I was adamant, so I requested a female, but they didn't allow it. So they come in with this big needle. Bear in mind, needles are like my biggest fear. And they just bend me over, turn me around on the bed, because I couldn't even do that. I was so immobile.
So they forced you as well.
One's to restrain him, whilst the other pierces him.
And then they just shove this needle up my asshole and just squirt water in. And just start squirting water in. It was, honestly, if there's one moment I can say I've lost my dignity, it was that moment. I felt so
fully all vulnerability just on the table.
Interesting alternative to laxatives.
Yeah. I mean, it worked.
Like they enjoy it. It's like, we're not going for the laxatives this time.
Yeah, they're looking at the shove. All right, we'll take that one.
What are our options? I don't want to get gruesome here, but I envisage like the thing going in and then just like a volcano of shit
like
squirting
a projectile
out.
I think
that was a bit far, man.
That would have been too good to...
No,
it's the sort of thing you'd see on like South Park.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is, to be fair.
Like a parody movie or something.
Actually, on South Park, you know, they made a they've made a new episode, a COVID episode.
Oh, really?
I really want to see it. Nico said he watched it the other day. Of course, Nico's seen it. apparently, it's really jokes. They like tie in that Randy was the guy that started COVID by fucking a bat in China. Like, so do these guys have no limits? Do you know what
Literally.
I mean? Like,
well, actually, the Borat movie made the whole thing about COVID, how Borat spread it through the US. Do you remember?
Yeah, it's
in
true.
The end,
that we watched
funny.
That the other day.
I've not seen
Sorry
it.
For the spoilers, by the
oh,
way.
Shit. Oh, shit. Yeah.
Well,
I might have to edit that out.
It's not a huge spoiler. I mean...
it's the basis of the story. You haven't seen the new Borat?
No, I haven't seen it. I'm looking forward to it, though.
It's good. It came out on Prime and...
Yeah, it's okay.
We, like, got people to come around here and watch it. It was, like, made a whole event of it. But, like,
I don't think it lives up to the first one, but it was still okay. It was.
It's, like, it was also, fun. It was really hard because, obviously, everyone knows who Borat is, right?
Yeah.
And so they tried to, like, redo it, but everyone in America knows who he is, so they couldn't.
Yeah.
So he had to, like, bring another character in.
It's like in Practical Jokers, really. Yeah.
That's
just
a good show.
He just needed another disguise all the time.
Yeah.
Like that. But, yeah.
But yeah, Borat and chopped legs. I mean,
yeah, it's a great menu today on the podcast.
Shit. So yeah, so the hospital experience must have been mad. I mean, apart from the 2 weeks of you being there, you know, what was like the recovery outside of that? Because what happened after that? Did you go home or?
I split the recovery into two aspects, mentally and physically.
Yeah.
Physically is pretty straightforward. You just need a lot of hard work and luck, really. And
but is there like, have you got physios with you? Are you in pools and moving your legs? Blah blah blah.
Yeah, literally all of that. So, okay. Well, that was quite late on. At first, it was really just going in. So I had 70 stitches.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was really going in and getting those removed. That was the first process. And then slowly starting to use a Zimmer frame to start walking, and then eventually crutches. And it's like the whole evolutionary process, really. And then and then a boot, and then finally being able to walk. And it was pretty awesome. And all that took really was hard work.
But wait, so coming out of the hospital, you were in a wheelchair, is that correct?
Technically, I wasn't even in a wheelchair. I was just in a bed. But obviously, to get me to the car, they put me in a wheelchair.
Yeah, because I just wanted to know what was the like transitional period of like being in bed to actually walking again. So what was kind of that transition?
Then once I got home, they had the bed ready for me, but I was like, nah, I'm getting on that wheelchair. So I got on the wheelchair, mostly just because my house is a bungalow and I kind of figured out the sort
is
of race
course. Is your house a bungalow?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, shit, I didn't know that. Yeah, when I've been there, it doesn't seem like the kind of house that is.
Yeah, yeah. And, and I really wanted to challenge my mum to a race because she was also on a wheelchair. Unfortunately, she declined.
Because of her ankle?
Yeah.
Okay.
She declined, but I'd go zooming around, and it was really good fun.
your biceps must have gone pretty...
Yeah, it was weird. Because
a workout?
Yeah, yeah. One of them just was a lot bigger than the
other. Rafael Nadal, mate, 2009.
But that was really good fun. That time, as hard as it was, because, again, I had to have an injection every day, and they're like my biggest fear.
In where? In your butt?
No, in my belly.
Oh.
It was really weird. Yeah. But then it's a small price to pay considering I actually had my legs. Then there was the mental aspect. The mental aspect obviously is a lot more important. And that was the thing I focused mainly on. And when something like this happens, well, I got a massive creative urge. So I had all these ways of expressing myself that I'm really happy that I did, because if not, they would have still been stuck inside of me and I would have never really been able to get them out. So one thing was art. I did a lot of drawing and I had this, I remember, picture in my head sort of me in the propeller with chains on my arms trying to escape. And I had to get that out of me somehow, and it's not the sort of thing that you can just talk your way out of.
Yeah.
And I remember that people often say art and music is therapeutic, and it's true, it really is. Because I remember having jotted this down on a page, I just felt so relieved. It was as if it, you know, I just flushed it out of me.
But what's cool about that is, like, you know, the people that make music, they must have these moments. Obviously, they don't have events like what happened to you all the time, but they have moments of inspiration to get stuff out. It's funny that people must be more inclined, or people must be more... aware of the feelings that they're feeling to be able to get that stuff out, to be able to make music all the time. Because it's taken you an event like that to write a song, and then these people just do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, it's kind of how you express like your emotions, right? So some people obviously prefer talking about it, right, with words. Other people, like you said, they like to draw or, you know, do art.
Yeah.
Or even through music, like certain sounds, certain elements they bring into the production, like that could be, you know, things that they've experienced or were emotional.
Because you make music. I mean, is that going through your head when you're producing a track?
Well, I'm still in like early stages of production, so not really. But I definitely know how those elements come into it. Because a lot of people, like, I don't know, they'll be sitting by a tree, you know, pondering. And you know, they'll just record the environment, like birds chirping and things, and bring that into their track.
Yeah,
you know, and it's like that moment, you know, they were in. So yeah.
But I think some of the best songs, and definitely the best musicians, like, they often do that. They often put down their hardship on paper, like people like Eminem, you know, who had a really tough upbringing, or or I can't think of anyone else. But
yeah. Everybody in the 313, put your motherfucking hands up and follow me.
Great freestyle.
I've got the story of a friend of mine. He was in a club in London doing karaoke, and he was singing that song by Mount Kimby, "Now You're Just Somebody That I Used to Know." And he was like hammered, and the whole crowd was booing him off stage. "I get the fuck out of here, man." And he breaks into the 313 rap, and the like guys with the band behind started doing the kick drum for him. And he does the whole thing, and the whole crowd is up there going, yeah.
That's a great scene.
So sick. So you've been 2 weeks out of hospital at this point. You're at home. What's next? What's going through your mind at this point? You're talking about the creative side, the mental side. What other things got you through that? Important were the people around you? You mentioned that a lot.
So I think it's really important to talk about, you know, family and friends. It seems pretty obvious, but, you know, it's just so true that when stuff like this happens, your best mates and obviously your family are going to be there, and they really were. the things my sisters had to do they just made me laugh so much. So for example, my sister Sophia, when I was in the hospital, I was numb basically everywhere else just because I had so much pain concentrated in my legs. So I ended up doing a shit in my nappy without realizing. So when I went to adjust it, I realized that I put shit all over my hand. God bless her, because she had to clean the whole thing up. And then again, like, I'd wake up in the middle of the night feeling the propellers cutting my legs, and my sister Gabriella would be sat there, you know, ready to comfort me, and things like that. And obviously my parents and my other sisters and my whole family, to be honest, extended as well.
That's a crazy thought. That, I mean, I've had dreams like that feel realistic, but to have a nightmare like that, it must feel like it did it on the day, right? I mean,
yeah, dreams, it must be so like vivid.
Vivid, also, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you see in films.
You like replay the image? Like, was that the thing? Like, you were replaying?
Yeah, but it wasn't. That's the thing. I'd never really experienced it because it wasn't just visual. I felt it as well. You know, you actually felt the sensation on your legs. It only happened a few times, and to be honest, I think talking about it and being open, it's a game changer. You know, it just helps you so much, because those are sort of things that if you don't talk about them, they just build up and end up being way worse a problem than they would have been if you hadn't.
Do you still get those vivid images?
No. Very, very occasionally, maybe, but nah, not really.
Nice. I mean, not nice. Good. Good that you don't get those vivid images. Sick. So, I mean, one of the things you spoke about a lot was religion. That's a big, interesting topic, I know, but let's try and narrow it down as best we can. I mean, how big a part did that play in getting over this event?
Yeah, so religion's an interesting one, obviously, because it's always debated on a question of truth and falsity. You know, so is God real? Is God not real? By doing that, the people who are having this sort of discussion, I think, often forget all the other aspects of religion that are almost more important, because regardless of whether there is a God or there isn't a God, I've ended up a better and a happier person. So it's ended up beneficial to me in every way, because it gives people a moral framework. It gives them a community, you know, it gives them ways to express themselves socially and you know, again, with this community feel, things like weddings and funerals, they're religious events, but
they're good reasons for people to get together
and celebrate whatever it is they're celebrating, whether it's, you know, the life of someone or two people, you know, coming together. But
how would you say that your opinion on religion changed due to the event that happened to you? How can you explain that?
So I was obviously really fortunate, and when you have so much fortune in that way, you kind of, or something really bad happens to you that you feel you don't deserve, obviously, this case getting chopped up, you feel like your mind isn't centered. You know, you ask yourself all these big questions, and I was only 16, so there's a fear at the age of 16 to be asking premature questions that you wouldn't have been asking till you're around 80, you know, things like, okay, so what do I want to do with my life? Why am I even here? Why shouldn't I be dead? Because I was literally at the gates of it.
And yeah, sorry, just to interrupt, why don't you give these people a little perspective of the statistics of the accident? Because I find that pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's so, a good point. So these statistics sort of thing, I was told in the hospital by nurses or the surgeon coming in, and these were, to be fair, these were the things that kind of fed into my mind being a bit lost at the time, just not really understanding why I'd been so fortunate.
Yeah.
So for example, I was, so there's an artery that goes down the left side of your leg. I'm not sure what it's called, but basically it's pretty essential to life. And it was, and the propeller was 3 millimeters away from cutting it. And had it cut it, I would have just bled to death in the water and died. So that's a pretty short margin of life.
Yeah, that's insane.
3 millimeters away from death. Like,
wow. Yeah.
That should be like your t-shirt slogan. 3 millimeters
My Instagram
away
bio.
Yeah, fuck. Yeah.
You think your sperm winning the race was good? Try this. No, but another one was, so they were telling me about the records when I was there in the hospital, and in Andalusia, the area which I was at the time and live, there have been 52 recorded propeller related accidents in recorded history. 48 of the people have died, and 4 have been amputated, so they've had to lose their legs or their arms as a result of it. And here I was in a bed wearing a nappy, but at least, you know, I was,
you had your legs.
I had my I was sewn back together, and eventually now I'm doing everything that it's told me I wouldn't. So
what you're suggesting is that religion for you, it was a way to rationalize what happened to you.
Exactly. Yeah, so bring it back
that
to
it's not just an anomaly, it's not by chance, you're not a sum of numbers, that but someone's looking out for you almost.
Even if it is by chance, because I'll accept that there are probably a lot of atheists listening right now being like, yeah, but that's all just bullshit. It just was a lot of real luck. You know, you have 7 billion people eventually.
One's going to one. Yeah.
So
what would you say to them?
Yeah. Even if it isn't down to, you know, some God looking down on me, it's a way of being able to, as you said, rationalize it all and bring yourself, come to grips with what's happening and move forward. And it's a similar sort of thing to the line of thought that everything happens for a reason. You know, some people may argue, well, no, not everything happens for a reason. That's just stupid. But in believing that things happen for a reason, you then allow yourself the space to be able to find reason in the things that have happened.
Yeah.
So if bad things happen, a pessimist would just say, oh, why did this bad thing happen to me? And kind of just end up in a vicious cycle. Whereas if someone has some belief that it's happened for a greater purpose, they'll then end up searching for that greater purpose and ultimately finding it. You know, it's a similar sort of thing with religion.
No, I mean, what you're saying is really interesting as well, because I mean, people who are successful do this all the time. You know, you guys saw the Michael Jordan documentary, The Last Dance. Yeah. I mean, that guy gave himself every reason to succeed. Oh, someone in the last game gave me some chat, I'm gonna fuck him up, like, he's my motivation.
Yeah.
Like, even if it's not right, like, even if it's wrong, as you said, and it is by chance, if that's the thing that's gonna get you up in the morning and work and like progress, like, there's, I mean, what's wrong with
it? Yeah, and that's the thing.
It's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. That's what I mean with religion, because people often get caught in the fact that, oh, is it real or is it not real? Regardless of whether it's real or not, no one will ever be able to prove that. It's something that is inconceivable to humans. Like, and that's just a fact, you know, that's the only fact. But ultimately, if it's the best blueprint to a happy life, I'm taking it, you know, and that's why I live by Christianity, you know.
Yeah, so you read the Bible your time in the hospital or after?
It was
that?
Just before, actually, yeah.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was just before.
What was your, I mean, I wanted to ask this because I haven't read it, like, it's a massive book. I mean, what sticks out for you? I mean, that might be hard. Was there one passage, I don't know, or something that you read and you were like, holy shit?
Well, yeah, more generally, it was just the messages in the Psalms. The Psalms, I think, are the best part of it, because they give you, like, if you take them literally, if you take anything literally in the Bible, you're screwed, like, because it's just complete gibberish if you do that.
You have to know how to interpret it properly.
Yeah, it's all about interpretation and cultural context, because things like, he shall be stoned 2,000 years ago, that was perfectly fine, you know? That was just a way of conveying that
that was their legal system,
That was just a way of showing that if you do this, it's wrong. But if you take it with a pinch of salt, then now, okay, it doesn't literally mean he shall be stoned.
Yeah.
You shall be fined 100 pounds.
Yeah.
Consequences for actions, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But I'd say, yeah, it was that. It was being able to look at it and see that what I'd been told was the way I should live actually was the way I wanted to live. And it was kind of just reaffirming that, because at 16, up to 16, I feel like your mind is kind of taking in things from people that you admire or are taught to admire, and you kind of live by that. But by 16, you know, you're starting to think for yourself, and I just wanted to make sure that that was really the way I wanted to live, and it was.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So, I mean, I want to talk, I mean, we can jump back to this sort of stuff if we like, but one of the things we spoke about before the podcast was what this event made you realize in terms of what it is you wanted to do with your life. And I know that's tied in with your trip to Tanzania,
yeah.
But how important was, you know, I think I made the relation to what we've been through as a planet, the COVID crisis, and how still everything was and how everyone had time to think about what it is they wanted to do. I started this podcast during COVID. I started my website, got into writing. I'm now got a job as a content editor.
Wait.
You know, so how important was that for you, the stillness in realizing it, what it is what you wanted to do in the future?
Well, yeah, as you said, like it draws a lot of parallels with COVID now, in that you kind of get a rest from reality. So I was there not living out my summer as I thought I would when everyone else was partying, and I'm fine with that because it gave me the space to actually process everything. Being rational was really important in not letting myself be taken away. But yeah, so this time just made me ask, as I said, a lot of premature questions. I started thinking, what is it that I really want to do with my life? And this had tied in with Tanzania, where I'd actually witnessed all these problems that were occurring, not as a result of their own, you know, lack of work ethic or governmental systems. It was more the fact that they had been exploited, or governmental systems had been put in place by the West for them to fail. And a mix of all this, as well as not going back to school, it just gave me the time to really explore.
You spoke about like the West drawing lines in countries like in Africa and stuff like that. I don't know if you guys read Prisoners of Geography?
No, haven't read it.
Yeah, yeah.
You read that?
Yeah.
They explained that really well and how they did it in the Middle East.
Yeah,
I thought that was a really cool book.
Yeah, exactly. In the Middle East, you have the exact same sort of thing. What was Palestine, now Israel, is just completely up in arms with each other. And
guys, I'm going to get another beer. I'm going to keep this running, but do you guys want one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, got it.
No. Okay, Lewis, so during your short amount of time on the wheelchair, you did mention before the podcast you had certain goals. So why don't you tell us about those goals?
Yeah, so I gave myself three goals for my time during a wheelchair, and I kind of did them as a joke, not expecting them to actually manifest themselves. So one of them was make a song on Spotify, which obviously happened.
Tick.
Boom. The second one was to get with three girls for the 3 weeks that I'd been in a bed.
How did you make that possible? I mean,
they love the scars, mate. They love the scars.
That's the secret.
They love the chat.
The secret is get a wheelchair.
You roll in and they all just surround you.
They see me rolling.
Yeah. And then the third one, which was at first a complete joke, was to get a lap dance from a stripper. Because obviously you're in a wheelchair, so it's pretty easy. And
it's
almost
like it's made for that.
It's almost like American Pie bucket list.
Yeah. And I really wasn't expecting that one to come true. But it was the 22nd of August.
What is it with you and dates, bro? Like, I mean, I understand the date of getting chopped up, the 5th of August, but like the 22nd of August, I got a lap dance.
It was a stormy night. Nah, okay, fine. It wasn't the 22nd of August, I guess. and it was GCSE results day, and everyone my age, you know, was out partying and having fun, and, you know, obviously, great. They deserved it. But I was at home. Oh, fuck. Can we crop that bit out?
Yeah.
I don't know why. It just sounded a bit like, great for them. Fuck you.
No, don't worry. All right. Keep going.
So it was the 22nd of August, and it was GCSE results day, and everyone, I think, was going to a party, and obviously I couldn't. So my sister just asked if I wanted to go out with her and her mates to El Ghe, which first was pretty cool because, you know, it was the site of where it actually happened. So it was good to go there and, you know, get it off my mental. But also just to have a great night. And so we were there chatting, and I was there with her mates who are around, what, 20, 22, 21 at the time. And they were all talking about how they'd never been to this club. Bar club thing. So I said, yeah, let's go. And they were a bit hesitant, but I was like, yeah, come on, let's do it. So they rolled me over and they rolled me to this club. Little did I know it was Club Nautica, the strip club I pass every day in the summer to go to the beach. And it was almost surreal. So we're entering the club, and they kind of just roll me up to the stripper pole and just put the brakes on. I felt like a badass, but and I thought, yeah, this is funny, you know, like, and then we'll kind of leave, and that's that. I wasn't expecting it to actually happen. And then before I know it, they'd organized for this woman, a Dominican woman, to, you know, to come and give me a lap dance for 6 songs, which was really funny. Obviously, great fun.
You said that your sister was there as
yeah, they were all watching me, which was a bit odd. You know, you'd catch like eyesight with my sister every, you know, 3.5
Oh, minutes. God. You won't
just
forget
cry
that.
Inside.
You do not forget that.
Yeah. But again, just a great moment and a bit of fun. Yeah. Nothing serious, obviously.
And another thing that sort of I really wanted to hear was, you mentioned, we've spoken a bit about getting over the event, what it takes to get over trauma. You said you had humor, that was a big thing for you, but also the returning to the scene, or returning to the things,
like,
that were
getting
involved,
over your
getting
fear.
Over your fear. How did that happen?
Yeah, so that was obviously really important for me, because the two main things which people often either told me or assumed, and it, by no fault of their own, it's fair enough judgment, was kind of saying, oh, you'll probably never get on a boat, right? Or, oh, you're probably never going to play football again, right?
People said that to your face as well.
Yeah, but not in a cruel way.
No.
Just kind of a reality check.
Yeah.
Because that's what we assume.
That's what you think.
Yeah.
But was that like a motivation for you? Like,
that was a massive motivation.
Yeah, I am going to do it.
Yeah. First thing was football. And I remember playing, it was March. I'm not going to say the date because then you'll roast me. It was March.
Nah, say the date. Come on, I want to
March
hear it.
March the 14th, right?
Oh, God, there we
and,
go.
Love it. And, yeah, I had my first football match since. It was for the third team, but even then it was an awesome experience. And we ended up winning 2-0. I didn't get that glory goal, last-minute winner that, you know, you kind of dream about.
Yeah.
But it was still an amazing milestone. And ever since, I've been playing, which is really encouraging. But more importantly, it was getting on a boat, and more specifically that boat, just to kind of give a gentle fuck you to the propeller.
Yeah.
No, but it's really important, because when something like this consumes you so entirely, like, I was moving school because of it. I was, the only conversations I was having was about my legs. You know, how are you? And that's great, and it's good to have that sort of attention at the time. It helps you get through it. But to a certain extent, it's pretty draining. And so
it's very repetitive.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff,
and I was very happy telling everyone the stories, and it was good for me mentally to do so. But it was also really important for me to move on. And moving on, I remember the last sort of task before I could close the book and take it from an experience I'm living to a story I can tell was getting on this boat. And yeah, so firstly, I got on a boat, not that one, and it was a bigger one. And it was really important, I think, to do it not too early and not too late, because if it's too early, then, you know, you suffer the risk of, you know, obviously trauma coming back, things like that. But if it's too late, you start to hesitate, you start to think, oh, I'll never do it. So it was finding that perfect timing, which was really important. My family helped me loads with that. And I started off by getting on a bigger boat. So it was a bit, I felt safer, more stable, you know, and I gradually got into it. Then I got into a speedboat. So I think that the key to this was, it wasn't massive jumps. It was always pretty gradual and pretty important to me to just take it step by step. You know, not run before I can walk, quite literally.
Yeah.
And so eventually, it was a summer, and I'd been on a boat a million times, but not the boat. And I was on the boat, my boat, with my family, and this boat comes towards us, and I'm in the sea with my sister. My sister goes, "Oh, be careful, be careful. A boat's coming." And I'm like, "Don't worry, I got plenty of experience with boats." Joking. And then I realized that it was actually the that boat.
Shit.
And it was all my best mates on it, and it was awesome. You know, I went onto it. All my closest friends who were there the day were on it. I gave them a massive handshake, good hug, and we just said, "Look at us,
a year on,
look at
man.
All the good that's come from it."
Fucking boom,
boom,
nice.
Good. So, Lewis, you moved school. You got three girls in a wheelchair. You had a lap dance from a stripper. You made a song.
Living the life.
What else did Salta Grande School give to you in SIS, your short stint?
It was really important. More just because when you're going in and out of hospital most days, just for checkups and stuff. And when, again, like this sort of event is just kind of consuming your life, it's really important to kind of get out of it every now and then. And SIS was great because some of my closest friends who are really good to me, who came and visited the hospital, you know, brought me toys and all this sort of stuff. They were at SIS as well. And it was really good for me to go be with them, you know, just be a 16-year-old again and kind of distract myself, meet new people, go out.
Yeah.
I would have been just more stuck in solitude if I hadn't been there, because I would have just been at home, kind of not really knowing anyone. But this helped a lot in, you know, just keeping my brain active and doing things.
Yeah, and now you've got another circle of mates here in Soto, yeah, exactly. which is
and
awesome.
That's really awesome. It's just,
yeah, because you mentioned how you brought the whole, like, you, because you had friends in Jib, and then you,
it's just, yeah,
made
it's just,
them like meet,
you,
meet
yeah,
friends.
Brought yeah. them together.
Yeah,
brought
meeting
yeah,
yeah, people
yeah.
was just awesome.
Because my brother, Nick's brother, did that really well with his group. He was really good at, he's done it on three levels now. First, it was the Jib Soto. He was the one that basically brought them together, I remember. He worked really hard at that. And then he invited his mates over from England and merged them as well. And now his really good mate is living with, from England, is living with someone from Soto.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
so
really cool.
Like, that's really cool.
And yeah, so I've got a friend called Arthur. Arthur's at SIS. And obviously a lot of us guys go to boarding school. And he was, you know, he was good because he introduced us to a lot of the people there. And they're all great people as well. And some of the best people to me after my accident were there at SIS. And,
oh, really?
And yeah. And it was just great. It was awesome. And it's just good to meet people and get everyone just having fun around here and keeping it simple.
Keeping a vibe in Soto, because sometimes sure. that's scarce, man. What's your opinion on religion, Louis? I'm interested to know, actually. Spill the beans.
Well, what is my opinion on religion? I think what you were saying about the whole, is God real, is it not? Like, yes, that is also a question. But also, the question for me is, like, what is God? Like, yeah. Not the why, is it real, is it not? Like, what is it? Like, not to try and get too deep or philosophical, but...
I like it.
But, like, some people might think, you know, God's, like, living amongst us. Like, you know, like, I don't know, when you're... the energy you feel, the things that happen, you know, I don't know. Like, it's not personally what I believe in, but that's also the question that people should be asking themselves, like, what actually is it? But the interesting thing is that all religions have a thing in common, and it's, they all look up to a god.
Yeah.
I think they're all just languages of the same thing.
I think it's good, like, as you were saying, like, it's good. It gives people guidance, a form of community, ethical framework, you know, things like that. I feel like a lot of people are drawn to religion if they haven't previously, if they've experienced loss or like a traumatic experience, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a easy thing to like jump onto and give you some hope, you know.
And what was, sorry, I just got a question. What was the general theme of religion in Nepal? Because
yeah, it's an interesting question. There was actually quite a lot of Christianity there, but obviously mainly Hindu. But I think like 17% of them are Christians, and they've got like Christian churches cropping up all the time there. Like one of the jobs that I did out there, I remember when I first went out, I was working at this hospital, and the job basically didn't work out. Like I just kind of felt like I was being shafted in terms of what I was paying to live. So I like got up and left. And that website Workaway, which is epic, They like promote loads of jobs where you pay like $5 a day and you just like do, I worked at a eco farm, things like that, or you work at a school and you pay like $5 a day for lodging. One of the places I went to was like a hardcore Christian sort of school. And like I stayed there, I was like teaching the kids there. So that was pretty cool. But yeah, predominantly Hindu. But they're really into it. There's a lot of like spirituality in general there.
I feel also like traditional and like practiced religion is something that might diminish as the years go on. Like I feel like kids our age and the generation that are going to come, you know, into power and all these things, I think it's something that's going to be practiced less. I mean, you don't see kids our age going to mass and things. Like it tends to be, you know, our elders and stuff. So I feel like I think religion has kind of evolved over the years.
I think you made a really good point about being centered. And I think what you've mentioned there about how kids aren't probably heading towards the traditional sense of religion. But they're doing what you said, you know, meditation.
That's what I mean. But that's the
exercise,
whole spiritual side.
Yeah, the spiritual side of things, I think, is
that's
a big
why I mean
thing.
That religion, in my eyes, is something that's always evolving, right? And people might think that it's like set in stone because the Bible's written this way and this, that, and the other. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's something that evolves and. Yeah,
you hear that word of like being mindful a lot these days, and I think that's just like, again, as you said, an evolution of religion. It's the term that's being used, but I'm sure in the Bible they have terms that were used that suited those sort of times. So like, it's as you say, it's always going to.
And
be
the
changing.
Bible's been written and rewritten and reinterpreted like multiple times.
If you look at France, even nowadays, like even with what happened to this guy Patty, I mean. It's become a lot more secular, France, and they actually have a right to it that religion isn't imposed on them anymore as a society, and there's freedom to blaspheme there, and that's the sort of way this is going, and I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I think people should be able to express their own.
Did you guys hear about the stabbings in France today, man?
Yeah.
In Nice. Have you heard about that?
No, I thought we were talking about the beheading that happened recently.
No, I know, but I was just...
Da, 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 da.
no, but that I just came to my head. Yeah, it was like they're claiming that it was a terrorist attack, but in Nice, there was a guy that killed three people.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be another little uprising.
My dad was talking to me about it today. He was like, in days before, recently, Charlie Hebdo, the cartoonist... was like really provocatory to the Islam, saying that it's like they're the reason that terrorism is about, sort of thing. And then I think President Macron had made like a really dodgy comment about the Turkish Islamic president.
Tensions are definitely rising between Turkey and Macron.
Yeah,
and he's really up for cracking down on what he calls extreme Islam, which can, I guess, be interpreted in a racist way. But all he means is, you know, the sort of people who go and behead people on the street for showing pictures
just
of Muhammad.
They're extremists.
I think it's important, though, not to generalize. Because it's something that happens in the West sometimes, where you hear, like, a whole religion being generalized because of three extremists.
Yeah.
And
it becomes a stereotype.
Yeah.
Which is unfair to, obviously, the 99% of that religion that isn't extremist, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, for sure. Mate, so tell us a little bit about development economics. There's something you told us about last night. I want to hear about this.
So, basically, it all started in Tanzania. And then was really pushed forward by my accident in a weird way, because I remember going there and seeing that it was really just a problem of economics. And by that, I mean, you know, economics aims to look at things like how to allocate scarce resources to unlimited needs and wants. And there's massive problems with that, obviously. And you look at it and you go, okay, right, so here's the problem. Why is sub-Saharan Africa in such a state? Because I was in Tanzania. And a book I'm reading right now outlines it pretty well, that it can be one of four things, or all four. One of them could be civil war, which is pretty obvious. Civil war is not going to be very good for a country. And civil war is pretty likely in sub-Saharan Africa, just because when all these countries were drawn up, not much consideration was taken into various tribes, which may be in the area. Also, now there's an increase in tension with natural resources, which are being discovered in these areas. And where natural resources are found, there's obviously likely to be a lot of tension with who has the rights to them and who can make money.
Exploitation and all that.
Yeah.
From Western companies.
Yeah, which brings me on to the second reason, which is the natural resource trap. And it almost seems like a paradox, because if a country finds loads of natural resources, you'd think, oh, that's great, because they can then develop. But it's really not. It's great for the very few ministers who can corruptly sell them to foreign companies coming in who want cheap prices. And so what often happens is it's really great for the minister and it's really great for the foreign company, but it's really awful for the country as a whole.
How does economic solutionize that? How does it solve that problem?
Well, there's a few things that could be done. So one thing is, so the Nobel laureate of economics in 2020, for example, sorry, 2019, what he discovered was that auctions are a really good way of solving these issues. Because auctions, what they do is that they find the true price of something, the true value of it.
That's sick.
Yeah, and so by auctioning the rights to resource extraction, instead of a minister going and selling it to a foreign company flying in, what can be done is a more fair price can be found, because there'll be more competition. So the price will probably get lowered or rise to wherever it's, you know, fair. Exactly. And in doing so, they're more likely to sell it to a company which isn't as corrupt. And therefore the workers
will get paid.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you look now at in Nigeria with the SARS, so there's a lot of conflict there. And one of the main reasons is the discovery of massive oil reserves in Nigeria, which led to these workers being massively underpaid and a very, very few being, you know, massively overpaid, which then led to the anti-robbery squads, basically just to make sure that the rich could stay rich and the poor could stay poor. And now you look at it and there's massive conflict.
That's super interesting. Yeah.
I recall you telling us someone called Muhammad Yunus.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a bit about him? Because I found that pretty interesting.
Same, actually.
Muhammad Yunus is an awesome guy. I first found out about him because I was having dinner with the Felipeses, a good
family
friends of mine. Yeah, shout out. And Paola told me that, you know, that she'd learnt about him. And so I gave him a look and I read his book, Banker to the Poor. And basically what he does, which is really clever, which is, you know, in answer to your question, how does economics solve poverty or aim to solve poverty? What Muhammad Yunus discovered in Bangladesh was that, you know, there were millions of people, mostly women, living in massively impoverished conditions and not being able to do anything about it. And this wasn't because they had a lack of skill or because they had a lack of work ethic, because they were working, you know, hours and hours on end with no result. It was simply because they didn't have the money to be able to advance. They were stuck in what's called the poverty trap. And so what he did is he gave them very, very small loans, because usually these people wouldn't have access to loans, since they can't prove, they can't give collateral, which is basically a way of proving that they'll be able to pay the loan back. And by giving these people loans, they were able to start their own businesses, start their own, you know, whatever it was to make money and get the ball rolling, a ball that they couldn't have got rolling without these and what had them stuck in poverty. And
what was so important about these loans, you mentioned the payback time, right?
Yeah, so what was so special about these loans is that they were collateral free, so basically anyone could take them out without having to prove that they could pay it back, because he saw that was a problem, that poor people would often want to get money out from the bank and make money, but couldn't, because they just couldn't borrow in the first place. And so he decided, look, I'm going to give you this money purely on the basis of trust, because I know that you, as the poorest people in society, are more likely to pay back than anyone else, because it's your life on the line. I've got the biggest affirmation that you'll repay back than anyone else, because I know that if you don't, you know, this is your only way out. And it worked. So now he loans out to millions to poor people every year. and he's got one of the highest repayment rates in the world.
It's amazing.
Which is just so heartwarming to know that humanity's, you know, is actually, you know, it's got a 98% repayment. So
unbelievable. Did you say they have a year to pay it back as well?
So the beauty of it is that they'll take out these small loans called micro loans, and they'll have usually it's a year to pay back. So instead of having to cough up, you know, the exact amount of money with interest in X amount of time, they'll be able to pay really small amounts over a year.
Mm.
And that just makes it a lot more bearable for these people.
It's a bit more realistic. That's how long it takes to get your life back on track when you think about it. Like, how can you expect someone to pay a loan back in less time than that?
Yeah. And then it ends up being a virtuous cycle, because once they get their basket weaving company up and running, they can then use the money that they gained from that, apart from paying back the loan, to start buying more baskets and making more money, and then educating their children, and then their children, you know, hopefully go to school, get a job. And it all just starts getting better. And it generally works. It's not just one of these things which in theory works, but in practice it really does.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so
cool. I mean, people in those situations are always get dealt the shit hand, you know. I've been to Morocco numerous times. I've been to lots of places where there's poverty, but I remember going to Morocco one of these times with my mum, and we'd always go over in the Easter time when people wouldn't really go. I think it was Christmas, and we'd take all these clothes that we had in these, you know, those big colourful Moroccan bags. Yeah.
Classic.
And we'd take them over, and we'd always drop them off at a school or something like that, you know. And we made a trip out of it as well. We wanted to go to Morocco. It wasn't like, you know, we were having fun as well. And I remember going to this town. I think one of the schools we wanted to go to was like closed at the time, or we couldn't do it. So we just went to the nearest town in the area to like look for families just to drop it off. And we had toys and stuff. And two things that I found really interesting. The first thing in relation to your point is, you know, there was this mother. First of all, when we entered this town, none of the men were around. They were all at the top of the mountain where this bar existed, getting high and drinking beers. Yeah. Like doing fuck all. We later found out that these women also, like the ones that got all the water, and they had to walk like something like 4 miles or something to collect water and come back to the town. And on top of it, they spent all day making these pots to go to the souk. But obviously they weren't treated fairly. They'd sell it for nothing. And the person making the real profit was the guy in the suit.
Yeah, exactly.
So it just like makes no sense. Yeah. And then the second thing I found super interesting was that we dropped off these toys to the kids, and these kids had nothing, but as you said, they were happy, man. They were happy.
They're so grateful.
So happy. And we gave them these toys, and you know what happened? They started arguing about who had the better toy. And we were just looking on like, we've just created like a monster, man. Fuck. The brothers weren't happy. They wanted that one, and this guy wanted this one. And it was a weird thing, man.
It's weird because their culture there is maybe by just pure fact that they don't have it, but it's a lot less materialistic, so they'll be grateful for the things that are intangible, and that's pretty awesome, to be honest.
Yeah.
In Tanzania, they'd celebrate things like the fact that they get to sing all together in this room after lunch, or you know, just the weirdest things to us, but pretty awesome.
Yeah. No, I agree. Have you guys ever been in a room and sang with people apart from when you're hammered at 4 o'clock in the morning sober?
Wait, what do you mean? In what
as in,
context?
Like, sing a song, whatever, sing a song that everyone sort of knows and, like, really sing it, like,
yeah.
And you're not drunk.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
For sure.
You have?
I remember
maybe in church, actually, at school, I think.
Going way back, I wrote a song on Spotify.
That was awesome.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. I'm talking as if I was there. That was good.
Right next to me. So I'd had like trauma one night, so I, you know, decided to go to the loo. And when I was on the toilet, I started writing these things down, getting it out of me, and I just recorded it on voice memos. And then the next day, I sent it to my sister. She was like, you know, it's pretty good. You should upload it. And I thought, you know, why not? So I uploaded it on Spotify, and now it's got over 17,000 streams.
Booyah!
Boom. That's basically why I came on the podcast.
Yeah, he's just literally just flexing, man. dropping his song. What's it called? Let's tell
them. It's called
listeners.
Don't You Worry.
Don't You Worry, check it out.
It's not done on a microphone or anything, so it's actually not great. But
yeah, I'm interested to know what you used. Was there like an app
just
to
my
produce?
Phone. Just
phone.
My phone.
His voice memo. Right?
Yeah. How did you make
this? Oh, GarageBand on my iPhone.
No way.
Yeah. But sorry, relating that back to the actual topic was when I got back to school in England, this had been after like...
You were famous.
Yeah, this had been after, you know, a few months because I didn't go to school there. I didn't start the term with everyone else. They were all playing my song and we all just had a laugh just singing to it. Like,
no way.
But also, to tell us the sweeter side of that, actually, because you started getting people reaching out to you, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I found that pretty amazing.
Yeah, so that song ended up actually being really cool because, one, it was a great form of expression again, and expression's really important in getting these things out. But then I just had people, all sorts of people, some people I'd never even met, just messaging me saying, oh, you know, so inspiring, or oh, I had these issues, and seeing your reaction to your issues has really motivated me or inspired me to, and all these things. And it was so heartwarming, and it gave, going back to like reason or purpose, it gave me that feeling of purpose, you know, why did all this happen? Oh, well, this is why it happened, because now I've got all these people telling me that, you know. And that was really important in the process because it made me feel really good about myself, and it made me think, okay, so it's fine. Now I'm walking, I'm happy, and overall I'm really happy it happened. I wouldn't take it back for those reasons.
Yeah, I've got one thing I just remembered that I want to come back to. Going back to the stuff you were talking about, these people that have got no other option coming from poverty to take the loan and just make something of it. I think I remember, did you make like a parallel of that to yourself, that you're in a situation where you had only one option, which was to like get better, and like that was like a parallel you made in one of our conversations, or am I making that parallel?
Maybe, but let's go with it, you know? but it is so important. Like, you've got two options, optimism or just feel sorry for yourself. And optimism will always win. Yeah, light drives out darkness, sort of stuff.
With these kind of life-changing experiences, it's always like, it's either you play the optimism card, try and get out of it with a positive attitude, or fall down the rabbit hole, you know, and kind of get self-absorbed with all these.
Yeah, have you guys seen that movie, Catch Me If You Can?
Oh, great movie.
Do you remember the quote? It's Leonardo DiCaprio and his dad is Christopher Walken, and his dad says to him, there are two mice in a bowl of cream. And he's like, one of them drowned and the other one, he churned that cream until it turns into butter, and he climbed his way out the bowl. And it's like, which mice are you, motherfucker?
Oh, shit.
I thought that was sick.
Yeah.
Great movie. So development economics and... Mate, where are we at, guys?
Wait, can you just cut this shit out, right?
Yeah, of course.
So basically... I really want to tell my story about like the hallucination on the mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah.
How do I like integrate it back in?
Yeah, hold on. Let me think of something.
I'll ask you about Peru and like altitude and shit.
Oh, yeah. Altitude and shit, yeah.
Wait, have you been anywhere cool?
Me?
Yeah, like, I don't know.
No, ask me about Peru. I got it.
Go on.
So what was like your experiences in Peru and the people there and the different culture?
No, it was good. To be fair, Machu Picchu was a weird one for me. So normally it was, if you want to do it with a tour or something with people, it's like 300 quid. If you do it with like a tour guide, blah, blah, blah. And I remember thinking when I was traveling, like, oh, I don't have enough money. Or I want to save, like, I want to make sure I can really drag out this trip for like 7 months. Like, I want to be able to spend a good amount of time in South America. So me and this guy, this Austrian guy I was with at the time, we're like, fuck doing the tour. And on top of that, if you wanted to take the train, which all the old people did, it was like $70. So we just walked and like taxied from Cusco all the way up to like Machu Picchu.
How far is that?
It was a long way. It was like 3 days of trekking. And we would like sleep along the way. And we ended up finding the train track, which leads all the way up to the town.
Oh, that's
so cool. We just followed the train track. And that was an amazing thing. Like the train goes right through the bosque, right through the jungle. And like we just followed all the way up. And when we got to the top, like the altitude was pretty crazy, eating cocoa leaves. Unfortunately, Machu Picchu, there was like, you can get it on a good day, obviously, if it's clear and you've got amazing views. I got it on a day where it was just clouds. So I got to the top and I couldn't see anything below me, which is kind of peak, but I still did it. But yeah, what about your experience with mountains, man? Did you do any of that in Tanzania?
Yeah, so when I was in Tanzania, we took 4 days to trek up Mount Meru, which is a mountain there, which is pretty tall. And so around 3 days up into the trek, I started noticing that I was getting some serious altitude sickness, probably because I've lived at sea level my whole life. Yeah, so I threw everything up, and I couldn't eat or drink because I'd just throw it up again. And we'd gone above the clouds. You could see Mount Kilimanjaro. It was an amazing view. But I was starting to hallucinate. It was my first and only ever hallucination.
Come on, we know you take a lot of drugs.
<Stop it. laughs> All that morphine.
Yeah, yeah. Thomas the Tank Engine just flying. No, but I was up there so dehydrated, and I'd strayed from the pack. I was just there with three local guides who are amazing people, and I saw my friend and I ran up to him and I was like, oh, his name's Ivor, I'm so happy to see you, I'm so happy. And I was like grabbing his face, and then I kind of just zoned back in and I was just grabbing a rock. It was right. So weird.
That was fucking trippy. Yeah, like I don't think I've come close to anything like that.
Yeah, it was so weird. But yeah, again, great experience.
What's the craziest place you've been, Louis? Travel wise.
Craziest place.
Or I mean, like most interesting travel experience you've had.
I mean, I did travel a lot in South America, but the thing is, I was pretty young. So it's when I first moved to Soto. I was about 9 or 10, and we kind of traveled like everywhere from like Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, you know. So those were really interesting places, but I don't think I was at an old enough age to kind of like experience the culture and all that kind of stuff, you know. But like in terms of like scenery and like beautiful places, like I think those are definitely the places. Like Brazil, we were in a resort like on the beach, like amazing. Uruguay also. Yeah.
How come you moved to Soto in the first place?
So, I was born in Paris, lived there 4 years, and then I moved to the States in Florida. And right when the crisis was hitting in 2005, 2006, like that's kind of when it begun, my dad got offered a position to work here in Spain, so we just moved here, and yeah, pretty much it.
DJing since.
Yeah.
Yeah, Louis doesn't like to talk about that. No, come on, bro.
I mean, if you want to just transition to that, yeah, I mean, yeah, I like music a lot. I'd say music's my passion for sure. But recently, I'm more into like digging records. So like secondhand 90s records, shit. All this type of
stuff. I went to his little studio for the first time and I was amazed, man. There's just like hundreds of records that he was DJing with. I was like, what?
That is so cool. Is it vinyl?
Yeah. Vinyl.
Mate, that's proper DJ.
I thought I had a collection myself in terms of iTunes, and then I looked at this guy and he had just as many on vinyl. I was like, what?
What's your all-time greats?
Sorry?
Your all-time greats.
Oof, I couldn't give you an answer.
Oh, really. Let's go deep discs right here, baby. Impossible. Let's steal the podcast. Desert Island Discs, let's go.
I know Matty has a favorite.
I've got track. A favorite track and artist, actually, if I'm honest. I've got my favorite track is whatchamacallit, what's his name, bro? No, I'll give my favorite artist first, Guru. He's part of Gangstar and he's got solo albums under Guru, Jazzmatazz Vol 1 to like 7. And my favorite song, how am I going blank here?
I mean, it's hard though to give like favorite song, favorite movie. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Too many on the list.
I think it's like changing. If you can keep replaying it every day.
Yeah, if you can't get sick of it.
That's the thing, and I don't get sick of that guy, Guru.
Yeah.
He's the all-time OG.
But yeah, kind of like, because this is obviously the Eureka podcast, but like I went to my first festival, I think I was like 15 or really young, 14, 15 or something. And just like,
which one was it?
It was Dream Beach, okay. Funny enough. So that's a local one, but it was pretty big. But yeah, just experiencing that, like so many people, good music, you know, the surrounding, like that really changed my life at that moment. Like at that moment, I was like,
that's when I
want to do that. Yeah, exactly. It's when I knew. Light bulb pops over my head.
Eureka, eureka.
Yeah. And since then, I just started DJing. Like I had a friend, he taught me, like got really into it. And yeah, man.
What's your DJ name?
Louie.
It's actually Louie if you think about it, because the E is capital.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah,
like
that's
Louie.
True.
But yeah. You've been misinterpreting.
I didn't really give it much thought, to be honest. Maybe there's room for improvement.
I think so, mate. You can ask the content editor right here. He'll come up with something sick, something catchy.
DJ Eureka.
Lewis, I want to close this podcast now, but I want to close it with what does the future hold for you? What's next? I know it's a very broad question, yeah. But if there's anything you want to put there.
Ideally.
Any closing comments, actually? Anything you want to tell the listeners and anything that you want to tell us about what you're doing next? What's next?
So the next move is hopefully economics at university. And then my three favorite things are probably traveling, economics, well, two. And so the course offers a year abroad. So they're pretty cool places that I could possibly go.
Where are you thinking of going? Yeah.
Hopefully Durham.
Nice.
And then year abroad options are things like Australia or even working at the UN University, which would be pretty awesome.
UN University, what's that?
United Nations, they have a university. It's pretty simple.
But what, just dedicated to people working in the UN? It's like a stepping stone, is it?
Yeah, kind of. And just hopefully to work towards getting the UN goals, which is, you know, basic things like climate change, poverty,
peace.
Peace, dude. So, yeah.
That's good. And any final messages from you, Louie, or you guys?
No, not really.
Well, thank you both for coming on. This has been wicked, actually. I've really enjoyed this one.
Me too.
And hopefully see more of you, Louie, on the podcast. Yeah, Lewis,
definitely.
Great to have you
on board.
Cheers
for giving me the opportunity, mate.
Yeah. All right, guys. Nice
awesome.
One.
Awesome. See you later.
See you later.